welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's, and I'm joined by my colleague, the center's other co-director, Mark DiTerolomi, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on iTunes or also on our website, lawandreligionforum.org. Well, today we're going to be joined by a third person, a guest. This is, I think, our first guest podcast on Legal Spirits, so we're very excited. We're speaking to Professor Kevin Walsh from the University of Richmond Law School about a case that's currently before the Supreme Court, the Little Sisters of the Poor case. So, you know, Kevin and Mark, I often think of this case as the kind of Jarndyce versus Jarndyce of law and religion, the case that just goes on year after year. Every time you think the case is done, it turns out, no, it's not done yet. It's already been up to the court. At least the issue of the contraception mandate has been up to the court already twice in the last few years. This will be the third time. So, Mark, I'm going to throw it over to you, and why don't you begin our interview with Kevin?
Okay, great. So, and may I add, we're very honored to have Kevin, a longtime friend of the program, and also very seasoned and experienced litigator in general, but especially in this case. So, you've been involved, Kevin, in this litigation, this general set of issues for a long time. And so maybe you could just sort of get us started. Tell us a little bit about maybe yourself and your involvement in this case and your work on behalf of Little Sisters. And then maybe kind of frame the background of the case for us a little bit.
Yeah, very good. And thank you so much for having me. This is a real honor to participate. And to talk about the Little Sisters case, this case, we might call it Little Sisters Act 2, because there has been a clear intermission in litigation. The two cases that were up to the Supreme Court before were really discrete. So this takes us all the way back to the Affordable Care Act itself, which included a provision called the Preventive Services Provision for women. And Congress basically tasked HHS with coming up with guidelines for what should be included in coverage. And HHS farmed that out to a group called the Institute of Medicine, which was a private group. That institute said, you should really include, require coverage for all contraceptive drugs and devices that are approved by the FDA in employer benefits plans. And so HHS said, that sounds like a good idea, and thus was included the contraceptive mandate, the idea that in order for an employer's healthcare to count as complying with the Affordable Care Act, it had to include this coverage. When it was originally promulgated, this mandate included an exemption for religious employers, but it was defined very, very narrowly to just cover essentially churches and religious orders, but just the religious orders themselves, not essentially their ministries. This was challenged by Hobby Lobby and a bunch of for-profit corporations because they weren't included. And it was also challenged by religious nonprofits who didn't qualify for the exemption. And those two sets of challenges led to the two cases that went to the Supreme Court. So, or two sets of cases. The first was by for-profit corporations, and they were saying, we are burdened by having to include this in our coverage under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Once we show that we're burdened by this, the government then has to show that there's no other way that they could accomplish their goal. And the threshold issue in that case was whether they could even assert a claim under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The Supreme Court said yes, and they said the for-profit corporations that were burdened by this mandate, that they were eligible to comply in some other way.
Okay, so that was, Kevin, that was the very famous Hobby Lobby litigation of, I believe it was, was it 2014? I think that was when the case was decided, or 2015, 2014, it was one of those two. But I know that was an extremely prominent litigation. But this litigation is a little bit different. This is about the nonprofits, right?
Right. So while the Hobby Lobby case was working its way through, the nonprofits said, we are entitled to an exemption as well. And the Obama administration said, well, we'll think about it more. well, think about it more. And so they went through another round of rulemaking. Some of the cases sat on ice for a little while, and some of them weren't brought. So the Little Sisters weren't in court just yet. The Little Sisters, at this time, I was representing them, and we just filed comments as part of the rulemaking process when the Obama administration said, we'll think it over. So we said, well, yeah, please include our ministries for the elderly poor. That rulemaking process ended with something called an accommodation. So this was an accommodation for non-exempt religious employers.
Uh-huh.
And the accommodation basically was an attempt to try to get the coverage to employees of these different employers while distancing the employers themselves from it. And one of the big disputes in that case was whether this was truly an accommodation that would extract the religious employers from providing the coverage or not.
And what did that accommodation look like, Kevin? What were the sort of the general contours of it?
It depended on what type of health benefit plan was provided. And so for someone that had an insured plan, so Anthem, Blue Cross, or Cigna, or something like that, the employer would provide a certification that they were not going to include the coverage, and then it became the obligation of the insurance company to provide the coverage sort of in connection with the plan, but not as part of the plan formally. For self-insured employers, there was also a certification process, and then there was a requirement that the so-called third-party administrators of the plan would provide a way to provide the coverage themselves. And so in each of those situations, the idea was, hey, employer, you sign this form. Once you sign this form, that acts as an authorization of sorts, and then the obligation to provide the coverage shifts to this other entity.
Okay, and Kevin, that accommodation wasn't satisfactory to your client and to the other religious, the nonprofits, and because they said this still made them complicit in an act that they considered gravely immoral as a result of their religious convictions. So they said it was a substantial burden on them. And that went up to the Supreme Court separately from Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby, by the way, was 2014. Then that goes up to the Supreme Court in a different case called Zubik. And as I recall, in Zubik, the court basically told everybody, you know, get your act together, you can surely work something out, and sent it back down in a way, or I guess sent it back to the parties to work something out. And then there was the election of 2016. You want to pick it up there, Kevin?
Sure. And Zubik was, as you say, it was a kind of non-decision decision. There were two big things that went into that case. Number one was that Justice Scalia had passed away. And so that went from a likely 5-4 win to the religious employers to a unanimous decision to vacate the lower court rulings and say, can you work out some sort of compromise? And the reason that they thought that that unusual approach made sense was that the government's position had shifted a little bit on the accommodation, and it, at least in our view, became a lot clearer that there was not much of distance between the contraceptive coverage and the plan, right? The government had said, we now have a compelling interest in seamless coverage. And if you have a compelling interest in seamless coverage, it's hard to say how it's separate from the plan. And so the negotiations really didn't go anywhere. The election intervened. And the Trump administration ultimately promulgated two new rules, one for religious employers and one for those with conscientious but non-religious exemptions. And essentially what these did was provide the kind of exemption that the nonprofit religious employers who had not been exempted but had been given this inadequate accommodation, right? It essentially gave them the exemption that they were looking for all along. So that was the end, really, of Act One. So Act Two comes in when you have state attorneys general who sue the Trump administration under the Administrative Procedure Act to set aside these rules as not within the agency's authority under the Affordable Care Act.
And Kevin, these are the new rules, right? These are the rules that give the accommodation to the Little Sisters and the other religious nonprofits.
Exactly. These rules provided the exemption that the Little Sisters and the other religious employers had been seeking all along. And so when the state attorneys general brought these suits to get those rules set aside, as you can imagine, the religious employers who benefited from those rules were troubled. And so the Little Sisters intervened as defendants in the lawsuit that was brought by Pennsylvania and then joined by New Jersey. And that's the case that is going up to the Supreme Court now.
And Kevin, what were the grounds for the lawsuit? In other words, what was the problem that that Pennsylvania and New Jersey had with the rules? Or what were the primary problems?
The Attorney General of Pennsylvania challenged this rule on the ground that the agency had no authority to make this kind of exemption. They were limited to deciding what had to be included, not authorized to decide who had to provide or not provide this sort of coverage. So it's a straight up APA claim, Administrative Procedure Act, to set aside agency action as in excess of statutory authority or jurisdiction and arbitrary and capricious, not legally authorized. As injury, the state said, once you allow this rule, we're going to be hurt because you're going to have employers who take advantage of it, and then their employees won't have the coverage, and some subset of those employees will take advantage of state benefits instead.
So, Kevin, it sounds a bit like the third-party harm argument that occupies a lot of the literature in this area.
It is a mixture of that as well as the harm to the state, because we might think, what business does the state really have going to federal court to take away the federal religious freedom rights of employers within that jurisdiction? And the state says, well, we're just trying to protect their employees. And so the employees would be the ones who have this third-party harm from the exercise of religion that doesn't include the coverage. Well, there is a case called Massachusetts versus Mellon that from the 1920s that says the state can't really sue the federal government as parens patriae, as sort of the protector of their own citizens with respect to their federal rights. So the state had to come up with an injury of its own. And in addition to the third party injury to the employees, they claimed an injury to the state fisc because they'd have to cover more coverage.
Okay, great. So what happened in the lower courts then? In the district court first, Kevin, and then in the Third Circuit?
When you try to parachute into a case as an intervener, you can go on two ways. You can say you can intervene as of right, or you can intervene sort of permissively with permission of the court. And it can be hard to intervene as a defendant when the government's there, because the government is presumed to represent your interests. But the Little Sisters argued that the government wasn't going to adequately represent its interest. After all, they had been litigating with the government the entire time. And now that the things had changed, they still had different interests from the government. The district court denied their motion to intervene. That went up to the Third Circuit. Uh-huh. The Third Circuit said, no, the district court was wrong. The Little Sisters could intervene. So they were on defendants with now the administration. And it moved to judgment. Summary judgment was granted to the state. So the district court said, yes, indeed, this was an unauthorized rule. The rules are thrown out. They are not enforceable. And the court, in fact, went on to enjoin the federal government's use of those rules nationwide.
I see. So Kevin, there are a few issues in this case, issues before the Supreme Court, issues on which the court has granted cert. And the first one I'd like to focus on is the standing issue, the issue that do the states actually have standing to bring this lawsuit? Because, of course, if the court says the states don't have standing, then this whole thing goes away. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that issue, please?
The district court ultimately accepted the state's essentially pocketbook injury argument that they would have to spend money for coverage for employees of these religiously exempt entities. The Third Circuit affirmed that determination. My own view is that that's really questionable and that it's really hard to trace some expenditure that the state will have to make. And the Supreme Court has been looking to cut back on state standing in different ways, but it is a kind of fact-bound issue. And so with it really depending on the effects of this rule and how many employers would take advantage of it and how does it interact with state benefits things, I would be surprised if the Supreme Court decided to end up saying the states never had standing to bring this at all.
So my impression, Kevin, from the petition is that it's the little sister's standing that is at issue, not so much the state standing. At least that's the issue that the petition raises, right? That's the first thing that they try to get through is their own standing, because in a footnote, the Court of Appeals seemed to say that they didn't have standing. Isn't that right?
That is right. The reason I focus on the state standing is because that one seemed highly questionable and the court had to spend a lot of time on it. But it's true. When it went up to the Third Circuit the second time, so the first time it went to the Third Circuit, the question was, could the Little Sisters intervene? And that panel said, yeah, this rule protects them and they have an interest in seeing that it's not struck down. So it was a little bit of a surprise the second time when it went up on the merits that the Third Circuit, pretty much sua sponte, right, on its own initiative, dropped a footnote to say the Little Sisters lack standing to appeal because they're protected by an injunction from the earlier litigation that had followed Zubik. We kind of skipped over that part earlier, but you had that litigation that was not definitively resolved by the Supreme Court. You had an election. The election changed the negotiating parties, and you had a settlement, which also included a permanent injunction protecting the sisters. And the sisters argue that the Third Circuit erred in saying that they had no appellate standing because this rule provides them broader protection than their injunction, and that they have an interest in seeing that the authority of the federal government to issue that rule is vindicated.
So, Kevin, these are interesting issues, these standing issues, but I'm sure that most of our listeners are on the edge of their seats about another issue, which is the RFRA issue in this case. And before we went on the air, you had written an email to us saying, you know, this could be the big one. Little Sisters could be the big one with regard to RFRA and accommodations. So why don't you explain, A, what the issue is, and B, why you think this could really be so important?
Yes, this really could be a big case because the Third Circuit just really got it very, very wrong. When you think about the question, did the federal government have authority to exempt the Little Sisters from a rule that substantially burdened the exercise of their religion? RFRA requires the federal government to avoid imposing substantial burdens unless they really, really have to. And so it's not even as if the exemption was simply authorized. It was required. As long as one views the setup of the so-called accommodation for the non-exempt entities as a substantial burden, then not only did the federal government have the authority, but they had the obligation to provide this exemption. That's exactly the issue that they were fighting about in the earlier litigation.
All right. So what the petitioners are saying is we object to the mandate. The mandate is still in place. We reject alternative means of complying with a mandate like the accommodation. That was just a scheme to get around what is and continues to be a violation of RFRA. And at any rate, that doesn't, you know, the federal government isn't bound by the scheme that they came up with in the Obama administration years forever. They can come up with alternative means of getting around this illegal anti-RFRA accommodation. That's about the situation, right?
That's correct. And if you think about the nature of the state's claim, again, the claim is that the federal government had no statutory authority to issue this rule. And there's really a double barrel argument that the Little Sisters have. The first is one I mentioned earlier, which is that RFRA requires this. And RFRA essentially allows what it requires. And then the second is, even if RFRA doesn't require it, even if there are other ways to accomplish what the government's trying to do, at the very least, it allows the government to do this. And it provides the statutory authority to do that, so that the government doesn't have to guess, right? Wait for it to be sued and then figure out whether a court will actually tell them they lose or not.
Okay, so that's why, in your opinion, the Third Circuit is wrong. But you also think this is going to be a big case, right, Kevin? And so why do you think this will be a big case?
The reason it's a big case is because the Supreme Court has never confronted this type of issue before, where a lower court had said, you just don't have authority under RFRA to create this kind of exemption. This type of authority has been taken for granted. This is what RFRA does. And so the Third Circuit treated RFRA as if it were just a rule for courts to apply, right? Rather than a rule for all of the federal government in implementing everything that it does under federal law. And that's what RFRA really is. If the government's following RFRA, they shouldn't get sued. And the way they follow RFRA is by providing exemptions when you have a rule that would otherwise substantially burden the exercise of religion and does not satisfy strict scrutiny. So the sweeping nature of the Third Circuit's rejection of RFRA as a rule that applies at the agency level, right before they get sued, the sweeping nature of that, I think, will lead to an equally sweeping ruling from the Supreme Court that says the government is obligated to follow RFRA when it is making regulations, when it is enforcing regulations. It is exactly how this is supposed to operate. And if RFRA operates correctly, if the federal government complies with it and uses the authority that is granted them, it never should end up in court. That's a backstop for when the government doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, Kevin. That's a really interesting point. So look, this case, as I understand it, was set for argument next month, but I guess that's not going to happen, Kevin. What's the situation here?
Well, it's unclear when it'll be argued because it was for the April sitting, but they have sort of postponed the March sitting, and we don't know when those will be argued because of the coronavirus-related shutdown. But the Supreme Court will hear it, and it will be interesting to see these cases. The Hobby Lobby case was a 5-4 decision. Zubik, as we mentioned earlier, was unanimous, but it really didn't decide all that much. What will be interesting to see is whether we see the same types of divides on the court that we saw in Hobby Lobby, or whether actually we'll see a broader rebuke of the Third Circuit's ruling. I will mention one other thing that's quite interesting about this case, and if people want to hear from an amicus that is not previously representing a party, right? So I'm not representing the Little Sisters anymore. I did file an amicus brief with Michael Stokes Paulson for his fantastic Law Review article, A RFRA Runs Through It. But there is an amicus brief by Professor Doug Laycock, who is an authority on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, one of its architects. And what's fascinating about his brief, which anyone who's interested in the case ought to read, is that he says RFRA authorizes this sort of thing even if it doesn't require it. That is, even if the mandate plus the accommodation didn't count as a substantial burden, the government could have reasonably sought to avoid the RFRA litigation and have been generous with its grant of an exemption, even if the accommodation didn't violate RFRA. And he had filed an amicus brief in Zubik versus Burwell, taking exactly the position that RFRA did not require an accommodation. So for a scholar of Professor Laycock's stature to come in and say, even if RFRA doesn't require it, it authorizes that, that gives you a sense that this is not just a normal 5-4 potential.
It sort of reminds me, Kevin, of the play in the joints doctrine when we talk about the room between what the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause require. This is sort of, it's like playing the joints for RFRA. It's, you know, you can do this. It's permissible to do this depending on various political considerations, And it's exactly those sorts of political considerations that moved the Trump administration to do what it did, just as they moved the Obama administration to do what it did. Would you say that that's about right? In other words, this is sort of these are political calculuses that are permitted by the law.
Well, not just political, but also legal judgments. And right. So the idea is the federal government is obligated to avoid substantial burdens unless it has to impose them. Sometimes it's not clear whether something will be subject to being struck down as a RFRA violation or not. Religion and the exercise of religion are preferred protected values. They can only be outweighed by service of a compelling interest and least restrictive means, and the government should be allowed to use its judgment to implement Congress's vision of the exercise of religion as a preferred freedom.
That's very interesting. I had thought, Mark, we had an agreement that play in the joints, that metaphor was not to be used in legal spirits podcasts, but I guess I was wrong about that. Well, Kevin, I want to say thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a great pleasure having you. Listeners, this has been another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on iTunes or also at our website, Law and Religion Forum, that's one word, .org. So Kevin, thank you very much again. And to listeners, we'll see you next time.